And someone can't take a day off when they need to. And what sort of message are we sending when the reward for caring so much is that we fire you?
An excellent point, Dwayne. Maxine hears Eric say, once again rejoining them at the table. You'd be surprised how deeply this sense of injustice would resonate with Steve. You'd know that if you spent any time on the manufacturing floor.
How so? Maxine asks. She's spent plenty of time working with the plant floor personnel.
Did you know that when Steve signed on as the COO and VP of manufacturing, he made it contingent upon the company publicly targeting zero on-the-job workplace injuries? He was almost laughed out of the room, not just by the board of directors, but also by the plant personnel and even the union leadership, Eric said, smiling. People thought he was naive, and maybe even a bit addled in the head. Probably because a real business leader would want to be measured on profitability or due date performance, or perhaps quality. But safety?
Rumor was that Steve told Bob Strauss, who was CEO at the time, if you can't depend on the manufacturing workforce to not get hurt on the job, why should you believe anything we say about our quality goals or our ability to make you money? Safety is a precondition of work.
Eric pauses. Even these supposedly enlightened days, leaders rarely talk like that. Steve had closely studied the work of Sensei Paul O'Neill, the legendary CEO of Alcoa in the 1980s and 1990s, who prioritized workplace safety above all else. His board of directors initially thought he was crazy. But in the 15 years of his tenure as CEO, net income increased from $200 million to $1.5 billion, and Alcoa's market cap went from $3 billion to $27 billion. Despite that impressive economic performance, Eric continues, what Sensei O'Neill talks about most is his legacy of safety. For decades, Alcoa has remained the undisputed leader of workplace safety. When he joined, Alcoa was rightly proud of having an above-average safety record, but with 2% of their workforce of 90,000 employees being injured every year. If you worked your entire career at Alcoa, you had a 40% chance of being hurt on the job. Alcoa has far more hazardous working conditions than in your manufacturing plants, he says. In the aluminum business, you have to deal with high heat, high pressure, corrosive chemicals, end products weighing tons that need to be safely transported. Sensei O'Neill famously said, everyone must be responsible for their own safety and the safety of their teammates. If you see something that could hurt someone, you must fix it as quickly as possible. He told everyone that fixing safety issues should never be budgeted. Just fix it, and they'd figure out how to pay for it later. Eric continues. He gave out his home phone number to all plant workers, telling them to call him if they ever saw plant managers not acting quickly enough or not taking safety seriously. Sensei O'Neill tells a story about his first workplace fatality, Eric continues. In Arizona, an 18-year-old boy died. He jumped into an extrusion machine trying to clear a piece of scrap material, but when he did, a boom released, swinging around and killing him instantly. This boy had a wife who was 6 months pregnant, Eric says. There were two supervisors there. Sensei O'Neill said they watched him do it and probably trained the boy to do exactly what he did. In the end, Sensei O'Neill stood up in front of the entire plant and told everyone, "We killed him. We all killed him. I killed him because I clearly didn't do a good enough job communicating how people must not get hurt on the job. Somehow it was possible that people thought it was okay for people to get hurt. We must all be accountable for keeping ourselves and everyone safe." As he later said, Alcoans were extremely caring people. Every time people were injured, they mourned, and there was always lots of regret. But they didn't understand that they were responsible. It had become a learned condition to tolerate injuries. Eric pauses to wipe a tear from his eye. One of Steve's first actions was to incorporate Sensei O'Neill's true north of zero workplace injuries into every aspect of manufacturing plant operations here at Parts Unlimited. One of his first acts on the job was to institute a policy that every workplace injury must be reported to him directly within 24 hours, along with remediation plans. What a magnificent example of the third ideal of improvement of daily work, and the fourth ideal of psychological safety. As Eric stares at the wall for several moments, Maxine suddenly realizes why Steve talks about workplace injuries at every town hall. He knows he can't directly influence everyone's daily work. However, Steve can reinforce and model his desired values and norms, which he does so effectively, Maxine realizes. Maxine stares back at Eric. She's never even talked to Steve. How could she possibly do what Eric suggests? From Chris Allers, VP R&D, to All Dev, Bill Palmer, VP IT Operations. Date, 11:10 p.m., September 25th. Subject, Project Inversion, Feature Freeze. Effective immediately as part of Project Inversion, there will be a feature freeze for the Phoenix project. We will make a maximum effort for 30 days to increase the stability and reliability of Phoenix, as well as all supporting systems. We will suspend all feature work so that we can fix defects and problematic areas of code and pay down technical debt. By doing this, we will enable higher development productivity and faster feature throughput. During this period, we will also suspend all Phoenix deployments except for emergency changes, and our ops teammates will be working on making deployments faster and safer and increasing the resilience of our production services. We are confident that doing this will help the company achieve its most important strategic goals. If you have any questions or concerns, please email me. Thank you, Chris. From Alan Perez, Operating Partner, Wayne Yokohama Equity Partners. To Sarah Moulton, SVP of Retail Operations. Date, 3:15 p.m., September 27th. Subject, Strategic Options, Confidential. Sarah, in confidence. Good meeting yesterday. I'm glad that I had the opportunity to share with you my philosophy of creating shareholder value. In general, we favor value and operational discipline over growth. Our firm has created outsized returns by investing in companies like Parts Unlimited. My plan would create fantastic and consistent cash flow at a rate higher than most people even think possible. At other companies, we've created considerable wealth for investors and company executives. As promised, I'm introducing you to several CEOs in our portfolio of companies whom you may be interested in talking to. Please ask them how we helped increase shareholder value. Sincerely, Alan. P.S. Did I understand correctly that there's now a feature freeze for Phoenix? Doesn't that put you even further behind? And now, what do you do with all those new developers you talked about last time? And what will they work on? Chapter 9, Monday, September 29th. On Monday, there's a spring in Maxine's step as she walks into the building. And it's not because of the dockside meeting. It's because it's testing day. Her code will finally be tested and put into production. She carries 5 boxes of Vandal donuts she bought on her way in. She even got some of their special cronuts, a crazy hybrid of a croissant and a donut, her favorite. She's feeling so good that she wonders whether the aroma of 60 freshly made donuts might be elevating her blood sugar levels. What a great way to break the ice with the people who will be testing her code, she thinks. It's always easier to make new friends when you bring tasty treats. Everywhere she walks, people ask her, "Are they for me?" She happily yells back, "Nope, it's for testing day." Putting down all the donuts on a table near her desk, she slings her bag by her chair. Tom is already there, editor open, typing away. "Hooray, it's testing day," Maxine announces happily, "at long last." "You are very strange," Tom says, not even looking up from his monitor. He sniffs the air. "Wow, are those Vandal donuts?" "Yes, to celebrate testing day," she responds with a big smile. "I think it's super exciting to finally see whether all our changes actually work or not," Maxine says. "So when do they start? Can we go watch?" Tom turns to face her, looking at his watch. "I suppose they probably start today. But it's not just our changes. They're testing changes to all the other big chunks of Phoenix. Ours are just a fraction of what they need to do. They might not even get to ours today." "What?" Maxine interrupts, shocked. She had been waiting all weekend for this. Can we see where we are in line? Can we help? In fact, where do the QA people sit? I bought all these donuts for them.
Tom looks surprised. Well, I've met a bunch of them. Some of them are offshore, some are on site, but I haven't talked with them directly in a long time. We usually meet the QA manager at the end of next week, when they present the testing results.
Next week? Next week? Maxine's jaw drops. What are we supposed to do in the meantime? Hey, can we follow along as they work? We'll get notifications on our feature tickets, right?
Not exactly, Tom says, frowning. The QA team uses a different ticketing system. It does their scheduling and reporting and manages all their test cases. We don't have access to it. At least, non-managers like us don't. After 2 weeks, they'll send us a spreadsheet with a list of all the defects they've found, labeled with our feature ticket numbers. We'll look through them, copy that information into our ticketing system, and then we'll fix anything that needs fixing.
And then? Maxine asks, fearing the worst.
QA rolls up everyone's fixes and tests again, replies Tom.
So, let's suppose that all our changes work perfectly. When would be the soonest that our customers actually get to use what we wrote? She asks.
Tom starts counting on his fingers. 2 weeks for another testing cycle, then they open up a ticket with operations, requesting that they deploy the changes into production. Sometimes it takes a bit of time for them to work it into their schedule. That could take another 3 weeks. He looks at his fingers. So that'd be 7 weeks from now.
Maxine crumples forward, groaning as she buries her head in her hands, her forehead on the table.
I am so naive, she thinks. Head still on the table, she asks.
And during that whole time, we're just supposed to work on more defects?
Yep, she hears Tom say. You okay, Maxine?
Yeah, I'm fine, she says, trying to not feel depressed. This is the opposite of the second ideal, she thinks. We're just a stupid feature factory. Pushing out widgets that customers may or may not care about, work is not fun and full of joy like I know it should be. There is no flow of features, there is no feedback, and there certainly isn't any learning, she thinks.
She hears Tom ask, can I have one of those donuts?
No, Maxine responds. Then she has an idea. She lifts her head and looks up at Tom, smiling.
But you can help me deliver them to the QA people. Finding the QA people was much more difficult than she thought it would be.
Tom hadn't been in the same room with one in over a year. His main interactions with them were through formal rituals. He turned over the code and waited for the list of fixes in a spreadsheet. Rinse and repeat until the team got the formal acceptance letter that the release was ready for production. Of course, it was never that easy. There would be all sorts of escalations up the dev and QA management chains because of disagreements and problems. Is this defect priority one or priority two? When developers couldn't reproduce the problem, they'd close the defect, only for it to be reopened by QA later. Or if QA couldn't reproduce the fix, it would bounce back to dev.
Maxine and Tom stop at Kurt's desk to tell him about their quest.
Those are a lot of donuts. What a great way to make friends, Kurt says. You tagging along too?
He asks Tom.
Absolutely, he responds.
I've always wondered where our work goes after we're done with it.
It's always felt like flushing the toilet.
You put your code in the toilet bowl, press the lever, and it disappears from sight.
Kurt snorts. Given the quality of the code we've seen in Phoenix, your metaphor seems pretty appropriate. Roy is the QA manager assigned to Data Hub, and he'll be tied up for at least 90 minutes, he says, picking up his phone, tapping out a message to someone. Go over to Building 7 to deliver those donuts while he's preoccupied. I'll connect you with Charlotte, who is, or was, William's assistant. She's like the mother hen for all the QA people.
Kurt finishes typing. She's expecting you. I think 3 boxes will be enough for the Data Hub team.
Ask Charlotte how to most strategically deploy the 2 remaining boxes, he adds with a smile.
She'll get a conference room for you and bring the Data Hub QA team by, Kurt says. You'll get a chance to meet all of them, and maybe you'll find some people who are looking for help.
Maxine smiles. This is exactly the support she was looking for. Thanks, Kurt. We'll go make friends. In fact, how about we get pizza delivered for lunch to give us an excuse to hang out even longer?
Perfect, Kurt says. Tell Charlotte to charge it to my old QA department code. With William gone, I'm sure it'll take them a while to shut that down. Let's take advantage of it, he adds with a grin. But before you go,
Can I have a donut?
He asks.
No, sorry, they're for our new QA friends, Maxine says.
Maxine and Tom walk across the courtyard to Building 7 with the boxes of donuts. They greet the security guard. When Maxine puts her badge on the electronic card reader on the side of the closed door, the light stays red. Maxine swipes her card again, but again, red light. Maxine sighs. She hadn't expected to not be able to get into the building. Interesting that developers can't get into the QA building, Tom says. Does that mean that QA people aren't allowed into the dev building? Maxine is about to call Kurt when she hears the door open. A cheerful elfin woman bustling with energy greets them. Right away, Maxine finds her irresistibly likable.
You must be Maxine and Tom. Kurt's told me so much about you both. Come on in. I was pretty sure that your badge wouldn't work in this building.
It's only a matter of time before Kurt's stops working too. We're all so happy for him. Well, most of us are, that is.
Many of us always knew that he was destined for bigger and better things than managing a QA team.
Charlotte's comment about destined for bigger and better things makes QA sound like an underclass.
Like Kurt had escaped some sort of ghetto, Maxine thinks. What a wonderful idea to throw a party for QA. I'm not sure anyone's ever done that before. Everyone will love it. I reserved the biggest conference room for the whole day. People will swing by whenever they're not in meetings and such, and I also ordered pizza for everyone in the lunchroom.
Maxine is impressed that Charlotte has taken care of every detail so quickly. In the conference room, Maxine sees that Charlotte has already written on the whiteboard, "We appreciate QA," with hearts on either side of the large lettering. After looking for a moment, Maxine asks if she can make some changes.
Sure thing, Charlotte is enthusiastic.
Maxine makes her changes. We appreciate our QA team members. She then adds the names of Tom, herself, Kurt, and the other five members of the Data Hub development team at the bottom.
Good idea, Maxine hears Tom say behind her. I suppose we should invite all the Data Hub developers to lunch too. Want me to send an email to them?
Maxine quickly agrees, adding, we're going to need more pizza.
No problem, I'll take care of it, says Charlotte with a big smile.
Over the next couple of minutes, members of the QA team start trickling into the conference room. Maxine introduces herself to each one. She notices that the QA people are demographically a little different than the developers. No one is in their 20s. Maxine wonders if that's because college grads are applying for developer roles instead.
So what is this celebration about? A woman with an Indian accent asks.
It's testing day, Maxine smiles, delighted to be asked.
I'm so excited that the features we've been working on for weeks are going to be tested. I thought it would be fun to throw a party so we could meet the people who are doing this important work and let you know that we'd love to help in any way.
Gosh, that's really nice, the woman says, returning Maxine's smile. I'm not sure if that's ever happened before.
Charlotte hollers from the other side of the room. I've been here for 7 years and I've never seen it happen. This is such a nice idea, Maxine. Let me introduce you to everyone. Perna is one of the QA leads and these are her team members. And then there's silence. Maxine wonders if everyone expects her to give a speech. As the host of the party, maybe she should.
So, again, thank you so much. We're having pizza delivered for lunch and the Data Hub developers will be joining us then, Maxine says.
What are you all working on these days? That's always a good icebreaker. They tell her about the projects they're working on, which provides a shared context. Then she asks what they find most frustrating about the testing process. The floodgates open. Their pain points and stories sound all too familiar to her. Waiting for environments, environments not completely cleaned up, the problems that cascade when something goes wrong, the inability to determine whether problems were caused by errors in the code or something wrong with the environment. Suddenly, she and Tom have lots of common ground and things to talk to them about. After all, everyone loves complaining about work. Maxine starts taking notes, and thus the party gets fully underway. After 90 minutes, it's clear to Maxine that it isn't really about dev versus QA. Instead, it's about how Phoenix business requirements change so often, which almost always requires urgent code changes. This reduces the time available for testing, resulting in poorer quality, as evidenced by the latest Phoenix disaster. Everyone understands that change is a part of life, but the Phoenix project seems ill-suited to this rapid pace of change.
And everyone, absolutely everyone, expresses real concerns about the decreasing quality of the Phoenix Project and the potential consequences to Parts Unlimited.
Someone says, in his town halls, Steve talks about what's needed from us. We're just not delivering what's needed, and when we find something wrong, there's not enough time to fix it.
There's lots of enthusiasm about the feature freeze, despite the ambiguity of what exactly will be frozen. People are excited that this indicates a real change of values from the top, and it's definitely for the better. However, many managers are convinced they're somehow exempt from the freeze. Eventually, the party moves to the lunchroom and 15 large pizzas of every imaginable variety are on the tables. The smell makes Maxine hungry. She's feeling a bit jittery from eating all those donuts. Her heart is racing, and she's even sweating a bit. As a borderline hypoglycemic, she needs to eat some protein soon, or she'll have a headache and a serious blood sugar crash. By now, scores of QA people have arrived. Maxine doesn't really know who is supporting Data Hub and who isn't, but she doesn't care. The goal is to make friends today. A bouncer at the door would have squashed that. Maxine finishes her second slice of pepperoni pizza and throws away the paper plate in the compost bin. After carefully washing her hands, she follows Perna to her desk. Perna has happily agreed to show Maxine how she performs her daily work. Maxine sees rows of desks packed more closely together than in the developer area, but not as dense as the help desk area where she met Derek. On Perna's desk are two large monitors, pictures of her with her kids, and a bottle of 8-year-old single malt scotch. Maxine gestures at it. Your favorite? Perna laughs, saying, not even close, but good enough for celebrations here. You need it working on the Phoenix Project. She moves windows around her screen and shows Maxine the release project that she has created in the QA ticketing tool. At last, Maxine thinks. She's been dying to see the QA team workflow. When Maxine sees the tool, she is momentarily taken aback. Is that IE6? Maxine asks hesitantly. The last time she saw that version of Internet Explorer was in Windows XP. Perna smiles, as if she's used to having to explain this to people. Yes, we've been using this tool for over a decade, and now we have to run the client inside of an old Windows VM. It contains all our test projects and runs some of our automated functional tests. There's thousands of test plans that we've built over 10 years in here. But IE6? Maxine asks. The vendor has an upgrade that supports a modern browser, but it requires upgrading the server it runs on, Perna says. We finally got budget for it, but we're still waiting for operations to provision it. This isn't the first time Maxine has seen people having to use old versions of Internet Explorer. They had some plant support systems back at her old position, where the vendor went out of business long ago. They've managed to migrate off of those systems, with one exception. They had to create a completely air-gapped network called 6.6.6.6 for a mission-critical server. It was running on a known vulnerable version of SunOS, which was completely unpatchable. Good times, she thinks. As Perna gives her a tour, Maxine sees that despite its age, the QA workflow application is very well organized and functional. Perna pulls up a network share with over 200 Word documents containing test plans. When Maxine asks, she opens up a couple at random. Some describe the test procedure to test a given user scenario. Go to this URL, fill out this form with these values, click this button, verify correct values at this other URL. Other documents describe the test plan for input validation, to ensure that every field in each form rejects any non-conforming input. Reading these brings back memories from decades ago for Maxine. After all, her first job was doing software QA. Great QA requires a perverse and sometimes sadistic intuition for what will cause software to blow up, crash, or endlessly hang. Maxine once heard a joke, a QA engineer walks into a bar, orders a beer, orders zero beers, orders 999,999,999 beers, orders a lizard, orders -1 beer, orders a SFDELJKNESV. Great QA people are notoriously good at breaking other people's code. They'll fill in forms with thousands of characters, unprintable Unicode characters, and emojis,
put negative numbers into date fields, and other wildly unexpected things. As a result, programs crash or wildly malfunction, usually causing developers to slap their foreheads, marveling at the diabolical test case. Some of these injection errors can be used by hackers to gain complete access and potentially grab all the data from the entire system. This is what led to some of the worst personally identifiable information, or PII, thefts in history. Finding these errors and vulnerabilities is very important work. Maxine feels awful that Perna and her team must manually perform them. During the next 2 weeks, how many times will they clean up from the previous test, bring up a fresh Phoenix application state, go to the right URL, type the same information into the fields? Perna shows other tests to check whether the feature actually worked as designed. Often, this means connecting it with other business systems in an integrated test environment, carefully engineered to resemble what is currently running in production. Maxine keeps thinking about how many of these great tests could be automated. It would liberate the QA teams from work that is tedious, time-consuming, and error-prone, and free up their genius to find more ways to break the code. Moreover, these automated tests would be run every time a developer checks in code, giving fast and immediate feedback that Maxine and other developers love. They could find mistakes right away and not make the same mistake day after day, week after week. Maxine doesn't say any of this aloud. The last thing a QA person wants to hear from a developer they just met is their ideas on how to automate their job away. Nearly an hour later, Maxine is still eagerly taking notes. Perna is being so nice, but Maxine feels impatient. She's here to see her code run and help the QA team make sure it's correct. Perna turns to her and says, "Well, that's about all we can do. The QA1 environment still hasn't been reset. We're waiting on a customer test dataset from the data warehouse team, and the Phoenix dev teams still haven't started their merge. Until we get those, there's really nothing we can do." "The developers haven't started merging?" Maxine says, her heart sinking. "How long does that take?" "We usually get something within 2 or 3 days." "I know they're always trying their best," says Perna. Maxine groans. In her short tour of duty with the Phoenix project, she's experienced almost every side of a ticket transaction. To get a Phoenix build going, she opened up tickets to what felt like half of the QA and operations organization and waited helplessly while they worked to get the things she needed. She enjoyed working on some Data Hub development tickets because they represented things that their customers needed. They marked them for QA as ready to test, and now that she's hanging out in QA, she discovers that QA is waiting on work still being done back in dev, and they're also waiting for other people to vacate the test environments they need to use. They're waiting for ops to provision a server so they can upgrade their test management system, and they're waiting for refreshed data from the data warehouse team. Where does all this madness end? "What exactly do you need from the data warehouse team?" she asks, reminded of Brent's data problems during the Phoenix release and Shannon describing her 5 frustrating years on that team. "Oh, everyone waits for them," she says. "They're responsible for getting data from almost everywhere in the company and cleaning and transforming it so that it can be used by other parts of the business. We've been waiting almost a year for anonymized customer data, and we still don't have test data that includes recent products, prices, and active promotions. We always get pushed down the priority list, so our test data is years old." "Interesting," Maxine thinks. "Data Hub is actually how the data warehouse team receives most of its data. More and more dependencies as far as the eye can see," she thinks. "There is no place in this whole screwed-up system where you can get anything done. It doesn't matter whether you're creating the ticket, processing the ticket, waiting on the ticket, or working the ticket. It doesn't matter. You're trapped in a web of dependencies, completely unable to get anything done, no matter where you are." "This sucks," Maxine says finally, sighing loudly. "I just hate all this waiting." "Actually, it's much better than it used to be," Perna says. This makes Maxine feel even worse. Perna stares at Maxine. Maxine feels like she needs to explain why she's upset. "I'm pissed off that dev doesn't have their crap together. We've got to do better than this," Maxine finally blurts out. "I know we sometimes contribute to the problem too,"
Perna says. Oh, great, Maxine thinks. On top of everything else, we're also suffering from Stockholm Syndrome.
Just then, she hears a loud commotion in the lunchroom behind her. A tall man in his early 50s is angrily yelling at Charlotte and pointing at the pizzas, and then at Tom and the other Data Hub developers.
Uh-oh, that must be Roy, she thinks. She quickly texts a note to Kurt.
Roy is here. You'd better come.
Excuse me, she says to Perna, walking quickly to the kitchen.
We can't have people here disrupting and interfering with our work. Of course, I certainly appreciate the gesture, but this should have gone through me. Next time, get my approval first, Charlotte.
Oh, but it just seems like such a nice gesture, Charlotte responds. I mean, donuts and pizza. No one has ever done that for QA before. What a very nice thing for Kurt to do.
Kurt's always up to something. This is just part of some scheme he's hatching. Roy fumes, waving his clipboard at everyone. Watching the scene are about 15 people standing motionless, eyes wide. Some look frightened, some look amused.
He's probably put all this food on my department code, Roy says, turning back to Charlotte.
If so, there's going to be hell to pay.
Maxine strides confidently into the lunchroom, extending her hand.
Hi, Roy. I'm Maxine, one of the developers on the Data Hub team. I'm sorry. This is all my fault. It was my idea to bring in donuts this morning. I just wanted to celebrate testing day with you and offer our help.
Roy shakes Maxine's extended hand, but looks blankly at her. He finally asks,
to celebrate what?
Testing day, Maxine says simply, unable to stop smiling. Roy's expression is nearly identical to Tom's when she brought up testing day to him earlier that morning.
I've had so much fun working on the features for Data Hub that I thought it would be just as fun to offer our help to test the code too.
Maxine points behind her to the conference room whiteboard, which everyone can see from the lunchroom, especially the big pink hearts that Charlotte drew. Roy looks at her, speechless. Finally, he releases her hand and says loudly,
Oh, no you don't. I don't know what you all are up to, pointing at Maxine and Tom and five other Data Hub developers who stand out in their t-shirts and hoodies. I'm pretty sure Kurt is up to no good, as usual. This is probably some empire-building scheme he's running, now that he's trumped up a position for himself in development. I'll get to the bottom of this. You can count on that.
As Roy turns to go, Maxine wonders how she can reiterate her message of, We come in peace. As she tries to decide what to do, she sees Kurt stride into the room.
Oh, hello, Roy. I'm so glad you're still here. Sorry for not coordinating with you. We just thought it would be fun to throw a surprise party. QA is the next critical part of the chain, and we want to do whatever we can to help.
At the sound of Kurt's voice, Roy turns around, his face red.
Oh, here he is. I'd like to have a word with you. Right now, please.
Kurt is about to respond, when Kirsten walks into the room behind him, saying,
Hi, Kurt. Hi, Roy. Mind if I join you all?
Oh, I love pizza. Maxine is surprised to see Kirsten. Other people are wandering into the lunchroom, watching the drama unfold.
I'm so glad you could make it, Kirsten.
Kurt turns to everyone. As we were walking here, we were talking about how important the QA effort is and that QA's concerns deserve a bigger voice. Kirsten, would you mind sharing what you told me? I think everyone here would love to hear it.
Of course, Kurt, Kirsten says, holding a paper plate with a slice of sausage and pineapple pizza.
As everyone knows, the Phoenix Project is the most important initiative in the history of the company. The disaster 2 weeks ago was a big eye-opener for everyone, especially at the most senior levels of this company. We have a lot riding on the next release. We have 3 years of promises that we've made to the marketplace that we're finally starting to fulfill. We just announced Project Inversion, the first time we've had a feature freeze to shore up quality, she continues. This is a demonstration of the commitment at the highest levels of the company, not just to do the right things, but to do the right things right. And getting you a code release on time is part of that. I know development is often late merging their changes. In our meeting with all the dev and QA leadership, they gave their commitment to deliver you something to test by 5 today, she says. We know how important it is that you have something stable to test, and that needs great development processes,
improving these processes will be a part of Project Inversion as well. People cheer, the QA staff clapping especially loudly. We're in a relay race, and we need to get the baton handed to you, she continues, gesturing expansively with her free hand. Your work is important, and my job is to help you get whatever you need to succeed. Thank you in advance for all your hard work, and please let me know how I can help. The room erupts in applause again, and Maxine joins in. She's reminded of a fancy party she was at in Chicago, where she saw the mayor of the city address the room. She was amazed at how gifted of a communicator he was, making everyone not only feel comfortable, but appreciated and a part of something special. Kirsten has that gift too, Maxine thinks. She's never seen this side of Kirsten before and is impressed. The crowd starts to dissipate, and several people make their way to Kirsten. Others approach Kurt, shaking his hand, congratulating him on his new role. Roy is at the back of the lunchroom, glaring at Kirsten and Kurt. At that moment, Charlotte appears beside her. Life is always interesting around Kurt, isn't it? I'm going to introduce myself to Kirsten. I've always wanted to meet her. She's so cool. We've had so many interesting people visit us here in QA today. Maxine sees Roy approach Kurt. She inches over so she's just close enough to hear him say, "This isn't over. You somehow managed to find a patron, but she won't be able to protect you forever. You think you're better than us? You think you can come in here and put on airs and automate everyone's job away? Not on my watch. I'll make sure we bring you down." Roy strides out of the room. Maxine looks at Kurt, who has an unconcerned smile on his face. He says to Maxine and Tom, who just joined her, "Well, that was fun. Don't worry about a thing. I saw that coming a mile away." "Worried?" Tom responds, laughing. "I'm not worried about anything. This is more exciting than your average day coding. What's going to happen next?" "Apparently, developers merging their code in a hurry to make a 5 o'clock deadline," Maxine says deadpan. Tom's smile quickly disappears. "Let's go watch," Kurt smiles. Chapter 10, Monday, September 29th. Over the decades, Maxine has tried to explain to non-technical people how frightening code merges are. Her best description is having 50 screenwriters simultaneously working on a Hollywood script when they haven't decided who the main characters are, or what the ending will be, or whether it's a gritty detective story or a bumbling sleuth with a sidekick. They break up the writing responsibilities between all the writers, and each writer works on their part of the script in isolation, typing away in Word for weeks at a time. Then, right before the script needs to be finalized, all 50 writers get together in a room to merge all their work back together into a single story. Of course, any attempt to merge their scripts together is a disaster. There's still no agreement on who the main characters are. There's hundreds of extraneous characters, completely disconnected scenes, and gaping holes in the plot, just to name a few of the problems. And most of the writers didn't read the memo from the executive producers that stated they were making the story a horror movie with giant undersea monsters due to changing market tastes. Merging code is equally difficult. Editing code isn't like editing in Google Docs, where all the developers can see each other's changes. Instead, like the scriptwriters, they create private working branches of the source code, their own private copy. Like those scriptwriters, developers may work in isolation for weeks, sometimes even months. All modern source control systems have tools to automate the merge process, but when there are many changes, their limitations become all too evident. Someone may discover that someone else has overwritten their changes, or that they changed or deleted something that everyone else depended on, or that multiple people made conflicting changes to the same part of the code, just to name a few things that could go wrong. Maxine loves it when everyone merges their changes frequently to the master branch, such as once per day. That way, the size of the changes being merged are never allowed to get too large. Small batch sizes, like in manufacturing, create a smooth flow of work, with no jarring disruptions or catastrophes. On the other hand, you have what Phoenix developers do. 100 developers work for weeks at a time without merging, and from what Perna says, it usually takes at least 3 days to merge. Maxine thinks, who would ever want to work that way? Maxine walks with Kurt and Perna back to Building 5 to the Merging War Room, which she thinks is a very appropriate name. The moment she walks into the room, she's hit with a wall of humid air caused by too many people being packed into a hot, crowded room. Looking around, she says to Kurt with certainty, "I don't care what Kirsten says, there is no way we're going to get a release branch today." Perna walks to the front of the room and takes out her laptop. On the walk over, Maxine learned that Perna is the integration manager responsible for making sure that all the promised features and defect fixes make it into the QA release branch. Everyone affectionately calls her the Merge Boss. Maxine looks at the printed spreadsheet that Perna gave her. There are 392 dev tickets to be merged. Each row has a ticket number from the dev ticketing tool, a description of the issue, a checkbox showing whether it's been merged, a link to the QA test plan, the QA ticket number, and on and on. Perna is responsible for getting all these changes merged so QA can finally test them as a whole. Find and report any problems, and make sure that any reported defects are fixed. It's a big and often thankless job. Maxine grabs a seat at the back of the room with Kurt. Gathered around the table are about 25 developers and managers representing each team with changes to merge. They're bunched up in groups of two or three, with at least one laptop in front of them. Typically, one person is typing at their laptop, with the others looking over their shoulder. There is a low buzz of frustrated conversation. "Sounds like developers merging," Tom says, grabbing the seat next to her. "You know the joke, what's the plural of developer?" says Maxine. "A merge conflict." Tom laughs, opening his laptop. "I might as well merge all of our changes into the release branch now. I usually don't do it right away, because what's the rush? I mean, look around. It usually takes days for everyone to get their changes in." He opens up the source code management application, drags and drops a couple of things, clicks here and there, and types something. He says, "Done," and closes his laptop. "I usually don't stick around," he says. "We barely have any shared code with the rest of the Phoenix teams. I can't remember ever having a merge issue." Maxine nods, thinking again about how strange it is that Data Hub is part of Phoenix. "Do you think these people will be done merging today?" Maxine asks. Tom laughs, pointing at the large TV in front of the room, connected to Perna's laptop. "Four changes have been merged, 5 when you include the one that we just did. That's 387 more to go. At this rate, I think it'd be a miracle if they're done tomorrow. 3 days, I'm guessing, at least." Over the next hour, as people have problems with their merges, more developers enter the room to help. When people no longer have room to stand, they create a second war room across the hallway. One of the managers gripes, "I don't know why we don't just pre-reserve 2 or 3 conference rooms. This happens every time." Maxine sees a dev lead type into a terminal window on his laptop, "Git pull." He immediately gets a long error message showing 43 merge conflicts. Maxine actually recoils from his screen in shock. She wonders how long it will take them to untangle that mess. Later, when she hears another team talk about bringing printouts of the source code for everyone so they can manually reconcile each change, she almost spits out her coffee. There's a group of 10 people crowded around the TV at the front of the room, studying a code diff from 4 different sets of changes to the same part of a file. Seeing the expression on her face, Kurt asks, "What's wrong?" Speechless, she gestures at all the chaos and disruption around her. "Developers should be solving business problems, not this. This is madness." Kurt just laughs. "For sure. All the dev managers are complaining about how much of a hassle this is. Some are lobbying to do these merges less frequently, instead of once per month, maybe once per quarter." Maxine blanches. "You're kidding, right?" "Nope," Kurt says, genuinely amused by Maxine's reaction. "If it hurts, do it less often. That's their reasoning." "No, no, no," Maxine says, dismayed. "They've got it all wrong. It hurts because the merge sizes are so large. To make it hurt less, they need to do it more frequently so that the merges are small and create fewer conflicts." Kurt laughs again. "Yeah, well," he says, shrugging his shoulders, gesturing around the room. Maxine doesn't laugh because she doesn't see anything funny. She looks at her watch. It's nearly 4:30. She looks at Perna's laptop screen.
Only 35 changes are merged, with 359 more to go.
They were only 10% complete. At this rate, Maxine thinks, it'll take them another 40 hours of work, a full week away.
The next day, Maxine is slumped in a chair in the lunchroom, surrounded by pizza. It's almost the end of the second day of the code merge. She stares at the big posted signs everywhere, admonishing, "For merged teams only." Maxine doesn't know why they bother. Over the past day and a half, she's guessing that every developer has been in one of the merging war rooms. "Maxine, there you are," Kurt says, interrupting her reverie. "Holy cow, you look like hell, if you don't mind me saying." Maxine just gives Kurt a tight-lipped smile. She just doesn't have it in her to explain what she's seen and how much it bothers her. Maxine knows that code merges are never anyone's idea of a fun time, but she wasn't prepared for what she saw over the last 2 days. She's seen managers copy source files from computer to computer on USB drives because their teams didn't want to use the same version control system as everyone else. She's seen people trying to resolve merge conflicts that were over 1,000 lines long, splattered across scores of files. She's seen people forget to merge in their changes, caught only when Perna reconciled her spreadsheet. She even saw two teams grapple with a genuine semantic merge conflict, a rare occurrence usually only found in stories that developers tell to scare each other. It's the result of an automated merge that compiles correctly, but wildly changes how the program functions. The worst part was that it was a near miss. They discovered it almost by accident. Frankly, she's amazed that they caught it when someone said, "That doesn't look quite right." Otherwise, it would have escaped into production, where it undoubtedly would have wreaked havoc. She keeps wondering how many similar errors weren't caught that are now in production, sitting there like ticking time bombs ready to explode when that code path is finally executed. Looking back at Kurt, she says, "I've seen things. Unspeakable things, Kurt. Such waste and needless suffering. No developer should have to go through this. This madness." Again. She's at a loss for words. "Ah," Kurt says, suddenly looking concerned. "Throw that pizza away and come join the rest of the rebellion. Shannon just reported out the results of her interactions with the Phoenix dev teams, and she has a great idea." Maxine looks down at her hands and sees that she's holding a cold, half-eaten slice of pizza, the cheese completely hardened into a white, greasy slab. She didn't remember eating it. She throws it away and follows Kurt without saying a word. Kurt brings Maxine to another conference room, far away from the ongoing merge madness. She sees Tom, Brent, Shannon, and Dwayne gathered around the table. They all smile and wave at her. Shannon stares at her for a moment, but unlike Kurt, politely says nothing about her haggard appearance. "Maxine, I think you're going to love this," Shannon says. "We've all been thinking about how all the data hub changes have been merged, but in order for them to be tested, we have to wait for everyone else to be done merging too. We're thinking about what it would take to get data hub decoupled from Phoenix so that we can test independently," Shannon continues. "If we can, we have QA people ready to work on our changes right now." It takes several moments for Maxine to understand what Shannon suggested, her mind still shell-shocked and ravaged from the merge. Then it hits her. "Yes," Maxine exclaims. "Yes, that's a great idea. We can't do too much for the rest of the Phoenix teams right now, but that doesn't mean that we have to suffer along with them." Kurt says, "I've been talking with Perna and Kirsten. They've assigned two people to help us get Data Hub tested and certified. As long as the Phoenix merge is still going on, they're ours. In fact, I bet we could get all our changes tested before then." Frowning, Maxine says, "But we still need a test environment to run Data Hub in." She thinks for a moment. "I wonder if we could create a Data Hub test environment to run in our cluster. It would be so much smaller and simpler than the Phoenix environments. That way, the QA group could use them anytime instead of the scarce environments everyone is always fighting for." "The environments team won't be happy about that," Kurt says with a smile. "What do you need?" She looks around. "If I had Brent and Adam's help for 2 or 3 days, I think we could get at least a simplified environment running by Monday.
I know Brent is on a Phoenix lockdown, but hey, technically Data Hub is still part of Phoenix, right?
Suddenly, Maxine is excited again. The idea of liberating Data Hub from the Phoenix Project morass is thrilling.
The first idea, says Brent with a smile.
The next day, Maxine, Brent, and Adam are furiously working around the clock to create a slimmed-down environment that they can use to run and test Data Hub. It's a race against the Phoenix merge. Perna gave a thumbs up on the plan. Kirsten did as well, saying, "We created all these rules so we can break them too.
Especially if this permanently eliminates these damned dependencies. Any project manager would jump for joy."
That was good enough for Kurt, telling them to go for it without bothering to get any approvals from further up the chain.
"I'll ask for forgiveness later if we need to," Kurt had said with a smile.
At that moment, Brent is trying to reproduce the environment build that currently only works on Tom's laptop. Meanwhile, Maxine is working with Adam, trying to get the last Data Hub release to work in their trimmed-down Phoenix environment. She's delighted that they're cracking yet another piece of the build puzzle that has vexed her ever since she was exiled. They're both watching a scrolling terminal window as Data Hub boots, hoping they resolved the last error. They're still watching the log messages scroll by when she hears commotion from the merging war room. One of the dev managers yells out, "I need everyone's attention. We've been having intermittent production issues for the last 2 hours on the e-commerce site. Something in Phoenix is causing incorrect or incomplete promotion pricing to be displayed when users are in the shopping cart. Does anyone know what could be going wrong?"
Good timing for an outage, Maxine thinks as she walks back to the war room. Virtually all the dev managers are already in there, so it should be pretty easy to figure out which part of the code is causing the problem. It's like having a heart attack at a cardiologist convention. Lots of qualified doctors are around.
As she watches, Maxine approves of their disciplined problem-solving. They are efficient, logical, and there's no hint of any blame as they try to replicate the problem on their laptops and systematically think through what could be going wrong. 10 minutes later, the middleware dev manager takes the lead. She makes a convincing case that the problem has to be in her area of the code. It takes only another 15 minutes for her team to generate a fix. "It's a one-line change. We can just push the change to the current release branch," she announces. "Oh, damn it. No, we can't. Only the SCM manager can push to this old release branch. We need Jared. Anyone know where he is?"
"I'll go find him," yells someone who runs out of the room.
"Who's Jared?" Maxine asks Kurt. Kurt rubs his eyes, trying not to laugh. The middleware dev manager next to them says in a tired voice, "Jared is the source code manager. Developers aren't allowed access to production. The only time developers can push changes to the release branch is for P1 issues.
This is only a P3 issue," she explains. "So either we need to ask Ops to change it to a P1 issue, which is never going to happen, or Jared needs to grant me temporary access so I can check in our fix."
"And if Jared were here, what would he do?" Maxine asks, knowing what's coming. The middleware manager says, "He'd take the commit ID of our fix, manually copy it into the release branch, and promote it into production."
"That's it?" Maxine asks.
"Yep," she replies. Maxine curses under her breath. To her surprise, she's actually angry, like actually mad. A couple of minutes ago, she thought the timing of the outage was fortunate. That lucky patient, she had thought. All the best experts in heart trauma who could correctly diagnose the problem and administer emergency treatment just happened to be in the room. But here at Parts Unlimited, doctors aren't allowed to touch the patient. Well, except if there's a P1 ticket open, but if the patient isn't on the verge of death, like right now, apparently only Jared can touch the patient. And then Jared just does whatever the doctors tell him to because, you know, doctors can't touch the patient. Jared isn't a doctor. He's probably just an administrator, just adding and removing users and making sure things are backed up.
"No one can find Jared. I think he might still be at lunch," says the guy who searched for him.
"Oh, for Christ's sakes," Maxine mutters under her breath. "It's happening again," she thinks, remembering how wrecked she felt in the lunchroom yesterday. Everyone tries to come up with a backup plan because no one can find Jared.
20 minutes later, Randy shows up, declaring nothing can be done, but he's still working on finding Jared. Everyone nods, going back to merging their changes.
"How is this okay?" Maxine says loudly, addressing the entire room.
No longer able to just watch.
"Why aren't developers able to push their own changes into production? Why do we need Jared to push the changes? I mean, I'm sure he's really good at what he does, but why can't we just do it ourselves?"
The entire room falls silent. Everyone stares at her, looking shocked, like she had just belched loudly at a wedding or a funeral. Finally, someone says, "Compliance," and another chimes in, "and information security." Around the room, she hears people utter other reasons.
ITIL,
change management,
SOX,
PCI,
regulators.
She looks around. All of these people are capable and responsible, and yet...
Come on, everybody. Those reasons don't make sense at all.
I think I know the real reason we aren't allowed to push our changes. They don't trust us.
Doesn't that bother you?
How can Jared know more about making changes than the developers who wrote them? Scanning the room, Maxine sees that only about 10 people are remotely troubled by her epiphany.
Do they think we'll deliberately sabotage the changes? That someone copying and pasting our changes can do a better job than we can?
Maxine knows she's pretty far out on a limb here, but she can't stop herself.
We're almost all developers in this room. Doesn't it bother anyone that we're not trusted enough to push our own changes into production?
A couple of people just shrug their shoulders. Several others stare back at her as if she's crazy or hopelessly naive. Maxine knows she hasn't delivered a stirring Henry V St. Crispin Day rallying speech, but she's dumbfounded that people aren't more bothered by this situation. She was hoping someone would yell out, "Hell yes, that bothers me, and we're not going to take it anymore." But instead, there's just silence.
"We don't even need guards anymore. We love being prisoners so much, we just think the bars are there to keep us safe."
She's about ready to leave when a young man with a ponytail and a laptop underneath his arm enters the conference room, followed by two people.
"Oh no," Maxine accidentally says aloud.
"This is Jared?"
He's even younger than the intern who helped her on her first day here. She has nothing against young engineers. On the contrary, her fondest hopes and aspirations lay in the hands of the next generation. And she does everything she can to help them achieve their goals. But it's so difficult for Maxine to think that Jared is more qualified to resolve this outage than everyone else in this room.
If Jared can deploy changes, we should be able to too, she thinks. Maxine watches as he sets up his laptop to perform the code push. It takes him 10 minutes to get successfully logged in, get the link to the code that needs to be pushed, confirm with everyone that it's actually the right code. Just like in all the movie scenes about coding that Maxine poo-pooed, a crowd gathers behind Jared, waiting in breathless anticipation as he performs his work. When he finally says, "It's in," people clap him on the back. Maxine rolls her eyes in frustration. She's glad Jared performed the work, but come on, all he did was a bunch of copying and pasting and clicking a button. When Maxine asks the middleware manager if the problem has been resolved, the manager replies, "Not yet. Now that Jared put it into the last release branch, he needs to work with the ops people to get it deployed into production. The patient still hasn't been saved. He needs to be transported to the next department for that." She decides to follow Jared, more out of a sense of morbid curiosity than any sense of adventure. 4 hours after following Jared out of the room, Maxine is dazed and disoriented. Any sense of well-being and excitement that Maxine had working on the Data Hub environments has vanished. And Maxine is missing something else. She is no longer certain about what is good, what is bad, and the processes that govern her world. She also feels distinctly unwell.
"Am I running a fever?"
It all started when she followed Jared 2 floors down to the ground floor, where operations resides. In an ops conference room, she recognized Wes and Patty, but almost no one else, although they all looked uncannily similar to each other. The room looked almost the same as the merging war room upstairs. Same furniture, same speakerphone on the table, same projector on the ceiling.
but sitting around the table are a completely different group of people discussing the exact same topic as upstairs: how to get this urgent change deployed. Only they're discussing slightly different obstacles. No changes outside of the maintenance window, ITIL, security, change management, compliance, different ticketing system. Same number of fields that need to be filled in, and the same errors when you miss a field. Same escalation processes, but different people. They've pushed an emergency change request to Bill Palmer, the VP of Operations, and Maggie Lee, the Senior Director of Product Marketing. And just like upstairs, everyone is standing around waiting for approval. At 5 o'clock, someone orders pizza. Maxine follows everyone to the lunchroom, identical to the one upstairs. When she sees the pizza, she almost trips and falls. It's from the same place as the pizza brought in for the merging lunch yesterday. The same pizza being eaten by different people, complaining about the same problems. It is then that Maxine starts to really feel sick, the room spinning slightly. Maybe I'm just hungry. But the look of the pizza instantly turns her stomach. Maxine feels like she's replaying the same scene of a movie that she just lived through 6 hours earlier. Like some horrible version of Groundhog Day, she thinks. Like Bill Murray's character, she is doomed to replay the same day over and over. But for Maxine, they keep changing all the actors. First, they're dev, then they're QA, then they're ops, but it's all the same. Up until now, deep down, Maxine suspected developers were being imprisoned by a heartless, evil, uncaring bureaucracy. Maybe it was run by operations or a secret ITIL change management cabal. But after following Jared into the heart of operations, she sees that ops is imprisoned by the same wardens as the developers upstairs. Who profits from all this? Who benefits by oppressing everyone in the technology organization? Maxine doubts that Chris or Bill are the wardens of this endless sea of prisons. If anything, they're prisoners too. Maxine throws away her slice of pizza before even taking a bite. Back in the conference room, Wes announces the urgent change was just approved. Maggie, the person who needed to approve the change, had missed their first calls because she was at her own birthday party, but she stepped out now to join the conference call. It takes 40 minutes to push out the change. Maxine watches.